You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Zed.
Yeah, it's great. Hey, Rob. How's it going?
It's going well. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. You are Zed Jelani, a distinctive voice on Twitter. I follow you. And I think it's safe to say that the phrase spicy takes sometimes applies. You also have a Substack called The American Saga. You've written for places like New York Times Opinion, Unheard. And you also, I want to flesh out your ideology a little. I mean, because I think it's a little unusual in its overall composition. Maybe it's wrong. We'll get around to that eventually. I would say you're not a friend of the blob. As we say in foreign policy circles, there are probably people who are considered woke who don't consider you a close friend. And I don't know what else. I don't want to define you strictly in terms of things you're not or are intention with, but that's a couple. We'll get to that later. One thing you've paid a lot of attention to is Middle Eastern politics and conflict. In fact, I want to eventually get around to telling the story of when you were at the Center for American Progress. And this is like, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, but you and some others there became a source of some controversy. And the Center for American Progress, this think tank, came under some pressure to make the output seem less of what I guess they deemed to Iran friendly, overly Iran friendly, or not Israel friendly enough. We'll get into that. The story's been told, like in The Intercept. Who wrote that piece? Did Glenn Greenwald write the piece in The Intercept about this?
I feel like Glenn did a piece for Salon, and then They did do some pieces about that institution though at The Intercept. Some reporting on different things like the UAE had a lot of influence there as well, and Saudi Arabia had a lot of influence. So it wasn't just Israel, but a number of governments.
And sometimes those three align, not always, sure. As now, but sometimes. Okay, so the Iran war seems to be just about back on. What is your overall take of like where we are and anything else you want to say?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think even former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State John Kerry have pointed out that this has been a priority for Benjamin Netanyahu in particular, right? Like he has spent years lobbying various American leaders to actually engage in this conflict, right? To try to militarily resolve the Israeli beef with Iran. Of course, there's American interest and issues there as well. And I think a big part of what happened was that if you listen to, for instance, like John Mearsheimer talk about the possibility of war with Iran like a year or two ago, right? He would describe basically exactly what happened, right? Everyone expected Iran to use the Strait of Hormuz as their primary point of leverage in a conflict, right? And I think what happened was that the predictions came true. And now it seems like the war is no longer over any kind of nuclear program, energy or otherwise. It's not over, you know, Iran's support for its allies or proxy militias across the Middle East. It seems to largely be over an issue that was resolved before the war had even begun, right? The Strait of Hormuz was open. I think what happened is that the Iranian leadership who's in place now, from what I understand, they actually felt like they have the upper hand, right? They felt like they were winning this conflict, that they've discovered that they have a lot of leverage over the West. They can actually bring the United States to negotiate with them, you know, get them to sit down at the table by using the Strait of Hormuz. You know, there's not really any evidence they were pursuing a nuclear weapon anytime in the past two decades. But I think now they kind of have a nuclear weapon, right? The Strait of Hormuz. I think being able to control, I don't know, a fifth of the oil and fuel supply in the world, you know, going through that strait, I think is a very, very powerful tool for them. And it may be that the Iranians are perfectly happy with the fact that the talks kind of broke down because they can continue to extract pain onto Trump and the Republicans going through the midterm elections, right? I think that's a real point of leverage for them. They understood that the only real countermeasure the United States have would be to do an Iraq-style invasion, right? With ground troops and thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of soldiers there, probably us enduring thousands of casualties. I don't think the United States is willing to do that. So unfortunately, I think we'll continue to have this back and forth. I would expect it to go through midterms at least.
Yeah. So on the point about there being no evidence of a weapons program, that's true. What, of course, Israel and some others would point to is the fact that they were enriching uranium to higher and higher levels. But that, of course, was only because Trump had gotten out of the deal, the nuclear deal that Obama forged. And, you know, Iran didn't even do, you know, anything dramatic right away. It was only after quite a sustained period of restored sanctions and so on that they started enriching to higher levels, still not quite weapons grade. But it just, I mentioned this because it just seems like the whole saga seems to be a story of Trump making things worse than they were before, starting with his first term. They were in much better shape with the Obama deal. And if you want to negotiate and apply the kind of pressure he was eager to apply and use it to negotiate a longer deal, pretty sure that was doable. It was doable before he attacked this time, I think. I mean,
and then
you're right. So not only is the nuclear, is Iran now, I mean, you said the Strait of Hormuz is kind of like a nuclear weapon. Yeah, well, also, I would suspect there's now more in the way of a drive within Iran to actually get a nuclear weapon. And there's no way to monitor it now because the whole apparatus of monitoring, which was quite extensive, is blown apart. So Trump, it's just kind of unbelievable. I agree that in a certain sense, Iran has leverage. I don't think Trump had any idea what he's getting himself into now, how hard it is going to be to reopen the strait without, as you said, ultimately sending in ground troops or doing something to, like, collapse the regime. I mean, my reading of the Iranian regime, we could be wrong, is that they're really willing to go to the mat to hang on to control of the Strait of Hormuz. And we can talk later about what they actually wanted as of a week or two ago, which was, I think, in a way, less than is being reported and was easier to give them and was almost explicitly given them in the written deal. But my reading is that you basically have to, Trump is going to either have to say, okay, I guess we failed, which is going to be twice as humiliating. You know, he had gotten over the humiliation. He'd gotten past that. And everybody said, a terrible deal. You lost the war. Okay, but that was in the past. And inflation that we learned today was starting to drop again. And now he's got a situation where he's going to make it twice as humiliating to back out. And as I read it, the only two alternatives to that are regime change and regime collapse, which means chaos, civil war. Both of those are fine with Israel. Anything that takes this regime out of action and or just degrades or collapses the Iranian state is they think is good news. I mean, I don't think it's good long-term news for Israel. Definitely good political news for Bibi, I guess. But so it's just, I have a theory as to how this happened, how Trump got himself into a much worse situation than he was in. But maybe we should quickly say why I think you and I both believe he's in it, which is that it's just not hard for Iran to disrupt traffic in the Strait of Hormuz. You can fire drones from well inland, okay? It's not a matter of Trump just bombing coastal sites and stuff. Drones are not very conspicuous, and you can fire them from lots of places in ways that will give them a good chance of just hitting a tanker. And just hitting the occasional tanker completely freaks out the insurance companies and the tanker companies. So that's why you basically have to run Iran, you know, to keep this from happening, unless the regime says, okay, we surrender, which I don't think is in the cards. I mean, do you agree with all that, first of all? And
yeah, I mean, look, I think something really interesting is that the series of events that led us to this really started October 7th, right? You know, Sinwar engineers this attack on Israel. He expects this attack to lead to an Israeli overreaction. That is what happened. There was some suggestion recently he even considered that Israel would maybe drop a nuclear bomb on Gaza. Like, he really expected them to. Well, and I think within the first couple of years of that, a lot of people considered this to be a great, like, at least tactical victory for Israel, right? They destroyed much of Gaza. Once Hezbollah got involved, they've destroyed a fair bit of southern Lebanon and crippled Hezbollah in many ways. They launched these attacks on Iran. But I think people have to separate what is a tactical victory from a strategic victory, right? Because now Iran is actually more influential and more powerful than it was prior to October 7th, right? It has a chokehold on the economy. It has major powers negotiating with them with nuclear-armed powers, could not bring the regime to collapse. And I think, you know, something like the Israeli military and intelligence, they can be very effective at targeting and killing who they want to kill, right? They have the technology to do it. They have the weapons to do it. They have the expertise. They had some level of intelligence infiltration in Lebanon and Iran. Not so much in Gaza, which is really interesting. I think that should be, there should be a question within Israel as to why they couldn't predict October 7th or why they even ignored some intelligence analysts who were predicting it. But being able to kill people and being able to build something up are two very different things, right? Like, for instance, the Russians or even we, the Americans in Afghanistan, were certainly very effective against Mujahideen, against the Taliban in terms of killing people with overwhelming force. But they ultimately, the Taliban won the war, right? And the reason they won the war is because they were able to endure. They were able to build more resilient structures, right? And actually do the governing part of it, which the government that the Russians have stood up and the governments that the Americans helped stand up was not able to govern effectively. It was not able to build the structures that could actually be resilient, right? To the what really was a rebellion in the country among the Taliban. And I think the same thing kind of is true with Iran. You know, there was a Times piece just out about how Israel tried to cultivate, you know, Ahmadinejad into being their guy in Tehran who was going to take over the country. And it was a miserable failure. Like, the entire thing was embarrassing, really, right?
He's a former president of Iran, a fascinating choice for that role for reasons we may get into, but you recalled him, I'm sure. Anyway, the thing is, he's, when Israelis or Bibi says, you know, Iran is an existential threat, they often trot out this quote that is translated as we want to wipe Israel off the map, is actually literally we want to erase the Zionists, the regime occupying Jerusalem from the pages of time. You can get into the nuance if you want. But the interesting thing is, I think the last Iranian leader to actually say that was Ahmadinejad. And, and he was, and at the time he became the icon of Iran's existential threat. And now we read that they were going to install him in I mean, you wouldn't believe the movie. I mean, that's true of so much about the Trump administration, but so go ahead.
I think that the competence of Israel when it came to destroying things and killing people is not the same thing as the competence in terms of actually engineering political and social outcomes in large countries. I mean, look, Iran is a country of 90 million people. It's very hard to social engineer from the outside. I'd say I've heard numbers anywhere between 20 to 30% of the population is actually very stridently in favor of the government, right? Those are people who are going to be enlisted in IRGC and in militias and so on and so forth. They'd obviously be the best fighters, ones with access to firearms. I actually think the government is very resilient there, right? There's, of course, going to be a group of people who would like to do another revolution or actually do a regime change. They're much smaller. They don't have access to firearms. They're not well trained. And then you have a large percentage of the country that, just like any other country in the world, just wants to live their lives, right? They're not trying to go out in the streets and get beat up or fight for something. They just want, like, you know, lower food prices or more consistent electricity or something like that, mm-hmm. right? So, and that's, that tends to be the case in every country. And I think the Israelis kind of got high on their own supply, and they sold that dream to Trump, which is why I think Trump was somewhat angry at Netanyahu recently. He felt like Netanyahu sold him a bill of goods. And yet Trump himself, as you said, because of his ego, he doesn't seem to kind of be able to stomach the kind of humiliation he'll have to stomach, right? Like, he has to kind of take a poison pill to actually bring the conflict to an end and also to stop threatening the global economy. Because, look, Iran has the upper hand, right? Like, America is not willing to endure what it would need to endure to take control of the Strait of Hormuz. The Strait of Hormuz does need a guarantor, right? Like, if Iran was not securing it, was not offering security for that strait, it would become a realm of piracy, right? there has to be some kind of strong country controlling it. Occasionally Trump says, oh, America will. And it's like, no, I don't think Americans want to do that. I don't think we're going to make that kind of investment. And I, especially in Iraq style war, that seems to be exactly what Trump campaigned against. And I think even Trump likes this idea of a quick war, right? Like, he doesn't like the idea of like a Vietnam or an Iraq or like spending years doing things. It's just that somehow he got deluded into thinking he could do that with Iran. He believed what the Israelis told him about a regime change, right? They were trying to arm Kurds and get them to rise up. I think at this point, the Kurds are intelligent enough to understand what happens when they do that. And just keeping the guns for themselves was a pretty intelligent move on their part. So,
yeah, Trump's pissed about that. Because, of course, he would never renege on a deal himself. So it's outrageous that the Kurds have done that to him. But, yeah, I mean, yours is not, I think, the most cynical take I've heard. You know, I think, as I understand it, you think Israel did buy the regime change scenario. In other words, decapitation will lead to a regime we like more. First of all, I'd say decapitation is one of the most famously ineffectual, if not counterproductive, things in all of conflict. Even if you look at like inner city gangs, there's a literature on what happens when you take out the boss of an inner city gang. Usually things get more chaotic and violent, okay? Because there's a struggle for succession and whatever, and sometimes it never culminates, and it's just chaos for a long time and more death. Not fewer drugs getting distributed. And it's the same in international affairs, and everyone knows it. You're just rolling the dice. You may well get somebody who's worse from your point of view, which happened here. Or it may just be that you get chaos, destruction, civil war. Now, that's where I say there are people who I think are more cynical than you who say, look, Bibi knew it might well not be a clean regime change that leads to a regime they prefer, but he'd prefer ongoing chaos, civil war, and mass death in Iran to what they had now, because then you wouldn't have a coherent state that can have an effective nuclear program and so on. But in any event, I mean, first of all, am I right? You have a slightly, well, you think the Israelis actually were buying the story they sold Trump?
Well, I think the best scenario for them probably is that they had a compliant leader in Iran, which maybe they were trying to do with Ahmadinejad. That's absurd thinking on their part, but maybe they were pursuing that. Probably maybe the second best scenario though would be a state breakup, because their real biggest beef with Iran is not just the potential of a nuclear program, but Iran is basically the only country in that region who finances their enemies, right? Who's able to supply weapons to Hezbollah and mm-hmm. Hamas, which serve as deterrents to Israeli foreign policy, and of course serve as an elevated national security threat. And, you know, Turkey does not do that. Pakistan does not do that. Qatar only hosted Hamas for diplomatic reasons, really. They were not giving them weapons or anything. And so if the Iranian state saw a breakup, you would not be able to have a coherent, like, IRGC organization to produce weapons to be able to transfer them, you know, missiles and things to be able to get to Hezbollah. Right. And right. So I do think that would maybe be a preferable outcome for them. But the thing is, it's such a non-preferable outcome for everyone else, like for Turkey, Pakistan, Russia, all these countries that fear Kurdish separatists, Balochi separatists. You know, I think those countries would view that as such an extreme scenario from their position that maybe they would even invade Iran, or they would take some other kind of measures to kind of prevent that from happening. Yeah. And I think that's probably part of why they were so intense in their diplomatic pressure onto Trump to try to end the conflict and push back on Israel. When you have a country of 90 million people and many different ethnic groups, and they border these much more powerful nuclear armed countries, I mean, I think everyone's hairs, you know, stand on edge. So, yeah, I don't know if that they were trying to induce a civil war. I do think from their standpoint, it's preferable because it's not a country that borders them. They wouldn't really be impacted by the chaos, and it would cripple their main adversary's capacity to supply their enemies, right? And that's what I think they really care about when it comes to Iran.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. If you look around the region, Iran, among Israel's adversaries and or enemies or potential enemies, Iran is so much more intimidating than any Arab state or even almost any collection of Arab states. The size of the population, the technological accomplishment, And Israel would like to, in some sense, take it out. And they were already talking when it looked like the war was going to maybe accomplish what they wanted. They were already talking about Turkey as the, because Turkey is another example of a Muslim country, not an Arab country, but a very formidable Muslim country. Right. It seems like crazy talk to me what you're going to attack a NATO country.
I mean, I don't know. I feel like Turkey and Israel, they say a lot of things against each other.
Yeah.
But ultimately, like, there's a lot of tourists who go back and forth, right? Like, there are certain, I'm pretty sure, like, Turkey could have taken additional economic steps against Israel, like, during the Gaza war, like,
oh, sure.
And, like, obstructing oil transfers and things like that. Like, I don't know. I don't know how seriously to take that. I do think maybe the far right in Israel would like to, like, pick a fight with Turkey. But look, even putting the NATO thing aside, Turkey has a modern military, right? Like,
yeah.
Israel is used to fighting dirt poor people who are using like small arms and fairly incompetent machinery. Turkey has like a military that could like destroy a substantial portion of Israel's military. Of course, Israel has nuclear weapons, so it wouldn't be an existential threat to them, but it would be a very foolish thing to fight with
them. But you were hearing like Foundation for Defense of Democracies, mm-hmm. you know, which is just the most pro-Israel, anti-Iran militaristic think tank in Washington, possibly. Start making noises about Turkey being next. Now, it could be a shot across the bow just to keep Turkey in line. And besides, it's just a think tank.
They also don't want Trump to transfer F-35s to Turkey. And
right.
That would put their Air Force at complete parity with Israel, potentially. So they do want Israel to be the dominant force in that region. So that's another reason for them to do the fear mongering and stuff.
Yeah, and to talk the talk. But I will say, you know, you said Turkey doesn't, does Israel really think Turkey poses a threat? I agree. But you could have said the same thing about Syria after the regime change. You know, it was clear that the new regime was going to cause no problems for Israel. But Israel immediately took out all the military assets in Syria just in case. So
there is also a group of Israelis who want to settle more in Syria, right? They want to take the territory.
Oh, yeah.
So that also helps drive that, I'm sure.
Yeah. And Bibi, you know, who knows where he exactly is on this stuff, but he's part of a coalition that involves extremists, and he's trying to stay out of jail, and it's all complicated. One more thing I'd say about, you know, one problem with attacking Iran, which Israel has now done, you know, twice, first in June, and both times America joined, is that, I mean, one reason you can expect it to lead to the kind of behaviors it's led to, which is a more militant stance on the part of Iran, in this case, as part of a new regime, is that, you know, in general, it seems to me one of the most pernicious and consistent dynamics in geopolitics is two sides that are at odds reading some things the other side does that it considers defensive as offensive. Okay. So if you say to a lot of Iranians, you got to understand the reason Israel attacked you is because among the populace in Israel, there is genuinely fear that you want to destroy the country. They actually consider this a defensive attack. Believe it or not, they attack you out of the blue. You haven't provoked them. They consider that a defensive attack. Nobody's going to believe that. It seems crazy if you're Iranian. I mean, a few Iranians might, but it seems crazy. And on the other hand, if you say to people in Israel, some, if not much of the point of maintaining Hamas and Hezbollah as junior allies from Iran's point of view is to have a deterrent. Mm-hmm. People in Israel say, you crazy? They're like, you know, according to media reports we read, they always start the thing. Of course, that's not actually true. That's another asymmetry that you get in conflict between the media and the two sides. But anyway, my point is, when Israel, having degraded Hamas and Hezbollah, proceeds to attack Iran, that is just to Iran a proof that it needed those deterrents, because once they're gone, Israel just attacks them. and proof that Israel is an existential threat to Iran. Because now that those two threats are degraded, why do you need to attack us, right? Because nobody thinks Iran, with Hezbollah and Hamas in such a weakened state, nobody thinks Iran is going to attack Israel. They weren't going to do it anyway. They'd never shown any signs of wanting to attack Israel. They either didn't know about October 7th or by some accounts told Hamas they didn't want any part of it, you know, and so you have reinforced now on the Iran, you know, the Iranian regime can make a good case that Israel is just an existential threat to Iran. Mm-hmm. This is a danger of attacking people out of the blue. They might draw the wrong conclusion. Anyway, there's one more thing I want to say before we go into overtime, but go ahead and respond to that or say anything.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that's often the case in statecraft, right? Which is that states really, they look at all of their behaviors defensively. This is essential for our national security. This is, preventing a formal threat. Right. They view themselves as defensive.
Right.
The people being aggressed upon often do not view it that way. They view themselves as defending themselves, right? So that's a common thing. And I just think Israeli politics today is very much live by the sword, right? Like, there's no way we can resolve our disputes with our enemies or our adversaries rather than fighting. And even when there was a ceasefire, when there are ceasefires brought about by Trump putting a little bit of pressure on Netanyahu, those ceasefires are very unpopular, right? Because I think a lot of Israelis are just like, we have no choice. Like, that's what they really sincerely believe, that they have to fight. It's not true, but within their social and political culture, that's just what they convince themselves it is. So,
yeah, I want to say this one more thing, give you my theory of the case of how the war started, why we're back at war. Apparently, I mean, I guess they could still rein it in at this point, but it seems to be getting harder. And have you respond to that? So the common thing to say is, well, the mistake was in leaving this agreement so ambiguous that Iran could read it and think they are being given the right to have ships check in with them on the way out. And by the way, I think that's all that was happening. I don't think there was any toll being charged, or I'm not aware of that. They just were saying, they got to, and I think that includes just remote communication. They don't have to stop and get inspected. I guess Iran would say, if we tell you to stop, you have to stop. But what they were asking, I think, was to, like, you know, send a text message on the way out. And Iran says, okay, you're clear. And the U.S. decided they did not want that to be, to Iran to get the idea it had the right to do that. So it encouraged, I think it got some UN committee to, in Oman, to sign on to this and say, okay, we've got this separate route over by Oman, and they were encouraging ships to just take that route and not check in with Iran, which is really asking for trouble. And the reason is the way the memorandum reads. But again, I don't think the problem is just misunderstanding in light of ambiguity that in retrospect was regrettable. I think the American negotiators, hey, you know, Jared Kushner's not Metternich, but he's not stupid enough to not understand what Iran was planning to do, given the way the memo read. I mean, I suspect there was an explicit understanding. Let me explain. So the memo, what it says, it doesn't say Iran has to let traffic flow freely or anything like that. It says Iran is responsible for restoring the traffic to its pre-war level within 30 days. It didn't even have to do that yet, okay? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't say how. It says you can't charge a toll for 60 days, but very explicitly says, however, that ends at 60 days. Now, the Americans are probably planning to renegotiate and hoping there's never a toll fine. But in any event, well, Iran wasn't violating that part, so far as I know. And the only reference, I think the only relevant reference to what American forces will be doing is there will be a withdrawal of American forces from the region. It doesn't specify naval, ground, whatever. But you take that together and it pretty clearly doesn't seem like American ships are going to be, you know, in Hormuz trying to you know, it assigns all responsibility, at least implicitly, to Iran, A. And B, if you were paying attention just casually on Twitter to all the analysts who from the beginning had the clearest understanding of the Iranian perspective, like Vali Nasser, this guy Azizi, an Iranian in Europe who I had on the podcast, I think probably Danny Sentrowitz, this Israeli guy, right? If you were paying attention at all, one thing you read early on is this regime is determined to hang on to control of the Strait of Hormuz as ongoing leverage forever and ever. They don't want to let go of it. So if you were just like reading something other than the New York Times, which I recommend, you would know, or, you know, the other mainstream, you know, Wall Street Journal and so on, you would know that the way Iran is going to read that passage is they and they alone are controlling Hormuz, and you're asking for big trouble. If you encourage ships to turn off their transponders and maybe some of them kept them on and take an alternative route, it's completely clear that Iran is going to attack those ships. And that's what Trump did. Now, I don't think that the negotiators themselves lacked an understanding of what was supposed to happen. I really don't. And I suspect there was even explicit discussion. I mean, if not, these guys, like, they should never be allowed near a negotiating table again. I mean, if all this conversation doesn't lead them to at least get clear on that, A, then they should find another way to make a living. And, you know, J.D. Vance isn't dumb. I don't really think Kushner and what's his name are dumb. But B, even if they didn't have the understanding, if you're paying attention at all and you see the text, you know what Iran has in mind. So I think there was the understanding, implicit or explicit. And then, of course, Trump, who is not smart and is getting older and crazier, I just think somebody got to him and said, wait, this is outrageous. Iran's not complying with the terms of the deal. And he can't read a fucking English sentence and understand it. I mean, this guy is so stupid. And so out of touch with the real world.
Well, I think he was the original New York Times article about how the war started was basically that Netanyahu presented Trump with the most rosy case possible of the Iranian regime quickly collapsing, there being a regime change. And you have to be kind of stupid to believe that in the first place, right? So Trump has already shown he does not understand what's going on. And unfortunately, I don't think this man at his age is going to change a whole lot. So
I think this was a repeat of that. I think it wasn't ambiguity that they should have resolved. These guys aren't that incompetent. It was Trump is, but the guys doing the deal weren't. The deal is done. All Trump had to do is sit tight. The worst was over. He had endured the criticism for surrendering, and oil prices had gone back down. All he had to do was not listen to Bibi or whoever called him and said, you know, Laura Loomer, Mark Levin, whoever, and said, do you understand what's going on here? You know, well, what's going on is exactly what everyone with a brain would have expected. And Trump basically just restarted the war by getting tankers to defy Iran, which just wanted them to like send an email on the way out. And it's just. Anyway, I'll give you a chance to say one more thing. Then we're going to go into overtime and you can regale us with the story of how you became you and some others at Center for American Progress's like media outlet, Think Progress, became a center of controversy over this very kind of issue generically and how policies at CAP changed as a result. But first, go ahead and say any last minute thing you want to say about this.
Yeah, look, I think we had a pretty accurate summary of events. It's pretty depressing, but I do think that it's possible that just there's at least a faction of people within Iran who are just they still think they have all the cards. The war restarts, nothing fundamentally is changing with the war restarting. And they think that they're going to extract more and more concessions by extracting more pain onto the economy. I mean, you have to remember that like a lot of the oil price, the gasoline price increase that we saw over the past few months was like a result of speculation. But at a certain point, we'll just like have less fuel, right? And there may have to be rationing and real dramatic spikes in prices. And, you know, a scenario like that, or a situation like that, to me, would lead to a blue wave that would take Texas, take Iowa, take Ohio. It would, I think many people in Tehran would be smiling at that outcome and that result, because they see that, you know, they actually, for the first time, utilize the tool that many people speculated they had, which was the Strait of Hormuz, and that they can actually bring a superpower to its knees, at least diplomatically, right, by using that tool. So I think there is some sense on the Iranian side, they're not in any big rush to resolve this either. But yeah, I think you're probably right in terms of Trump just continues to be played by a fool, like a fool by the other side. And I think that's a big part of why they haven't been able to wrap this up.
Yeah, the I will say that this is America's plan, to the extent there is a plan, inflict economic pain until Iran can't endure it. The regime can't endure it, and hope the regime falls or capitulates. I'm not saying it won't fall, but I doubt it will capitulate before things get very, very, very ugly. And we have ground troops in.
I think that there's just always been this sense when a larger power fights a smaller power that, hey, they just can't endure this level of pain. But I think, ironically, for a movement that builds itself as nationalistic, like MAGA is supposed to be about nationalism, they don't really understand other people's nationalism. There's a lot of Iranians who don't like the government, but they also hate this idea that a foreign power is bombing them, you know, attacking civilian facilities, inflicting economic pain on them. They have a sense of national pride as well, right? And that's a very, very strong thing, particularly among regime supporters, which I said is like 20 or 30% of the country, people who are well-trained, who know how to take part in combat operations, who have weapons. Mm-hmm. And it's just a very, very hard scenario. I'm not saying there couldn't one day be a revolution in Iran again, but I think it's very hard to predict, and it probably won't be imposed from outside. So, yeah.
No, I think the regime could fall. I don't think that would lead to good things in the long run for America. And I think we could be headed toward some kind of disaster we hadn't previously contemplated. So I'm not saying Iran will, quote, win. I'm just saying there is such thing as a lose-lose outcome, and that could happen. And I'm saying that what Trump is hoping will happen, like capitulation within a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, without him having to take American casualties or anything, I don't think that's going to happen. Anyway, this brings to a close the public portion. Now we go into overtime. You can get access to overtime by becoming a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter, link in the show notes, or go to Non-Zero and look for the post, for this post, for me and Zed. And before we go, I want to remind people, you got a very, very active and pungent Twitter feed. What's your Twitter handle?
So my Twitter handle is just my first name, last name. So ZAIDJILANI.
And your newsletter is The American Saga. And we will continue the conversation in overtime. Here we go.